I'm Wade Rausch, and this is Soonish. It's a show about the future, how we think about it, what we can do to shape it, and why our best forecasts and our worst fears are usually wrong. A couple of weeks ago, my old college friend, Sarah Barkin, and her husband, Mark Drayson, came over to my apartment for dinner. They were a little late because right before they were going to drive over, the sliding door on their minivan fell off. They had to go buy a big blue plastic tarp and some duct tape to cover up the hole, which was funny because, well, I'll get to that in a minute. After dinner, I made coffee and turned on my recorder because we podcasters are weird that way. So you're a multi-generational Bostonian.
Yes. My grandparents on both sides moved here from the old country. Yes.
Okay.
And I've lived in the city my whole life.
I'm going to go grab your coffee.
Talk amongst yourselves. Do you take milk, Mark?
I take milk and one sugar, please.
Okay.
A generous sugar.
Okay. Some people would define it as two, but yeah. He calls it one.
These days, Sarah works for an affordable housing agency called the Community Economic Development Assistance Corporation, or CEDAC. And Mark is the executive director of a regional land use planning agency in Boston called the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, or MAPC. So they're kind of a power couple in the city planning and community development scene around Boston. Now, I live in Cambridge in a 10th floor apartment that overlooks the Charles River. And from the couch where we were having coffee, we could look out the window and see a Boston landmark called the Longfellow Bridge. It's also known as the Salt and Pepper Bridge because of the distinctive towers on the midspan that look like giant salt and pepper shakers. I asked Sarah and Mark to come over partly because I wanted to talk about that bridge. I've been kind of obsessed with it ever since I did a radio story about it last year for one of Boston's NPR stations, WBUR. It opened in 1907, but then it was allowed to rust for decades, to the point where it was in danger of collapsing. And ever since 2013, it's been partially closed for a restoration project that's now years behind schedule and could end up costing close to $500 million. Sarah and Mark think about city planning and infrastructure for a living, so I wanted to ask whether they thought it was worth all the trouble.
Well, I'm a big supporter of saving the bridge. When I was a little boy and I drove over that bridge, my father told me, there's a salt and pepper shaker, and I did that with my kids, and I expect them to do it with theirs. And, you know, it's a little hard for me to... It's a little hard for me to explain, Wade, why that's important. But... a lot of what's important in Boston is about being able to talk about and feel and respect the history. And in order to appreciate that and feel it, you have to be able to see different things from those different parts of your history. But the Salt and Pepper Bridge, it was a particular architectural statement, an important one and a beautiful one, and I feel we should have saved it. Now, the expense of that project came from some particular regulations and processes, which maybe were extreme. It also came from the fact that we did it 20 or 30 years after we knew we had to do it. We delayed and delayed and delayed, and the project got more expensive, and the damage got more difficult to reverse. And if we had just raised some money at the very beginning to actually do it, it would have been a lot cheaper. And that's a real problem that we have in this city and in this state. Is that we often know the things we have to do, we complain that they're a little too expensive, so we wait until they cost three times as much. And to me, that's kind of one of those, you know, really classic definitions of insanity.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit like when you have a car that you know you need to replace, and you wait until the door falls off, and until you really can't use the car anymore. And you realize, you know, I probably could have replaced it a few years ago, and it might have been more efficient for my family and for my neighborhood. But you wait, and you wait. And that is a bit characteristic of how we are in Boston. It's our Yankee thrift, sometimes at its best, but sometimes not serving us all that well.
The Longfellow Bridge isn't just a structure that carries people back and forth between Boston and Cambridge. I've also come to see it as a symbol of the tension and the trade-offs between the past and the future.
I look at this bridge, and quite frankly, we could have built a brand new bridge and done it much more quickly, and it would be up and running right now.
This is Tom Keene, He's a former Boston city councilor who represented the neighborhoods adjacent to the Longfellow Bridge.
And you could have made a beautiful bridge that might be more reflective even of sort of what Boston looks like now, rather than just trying to say, oh, let's just replicate the past.
I interviewed him for my WBUR story last year, and his argument was that it would have been not just faster and cheaper, but also more forward-looking if the state had just demolished the Longfellow Bridge and started over. Now, as it turns out, there's a case in point right here in Boston. It's another bridge called the Zakim Bridge, and I'm standing directly below it right now. It's 1 mile downstream from the Longfellow Bridge on the same river, the Charles. And it's just a quarter mile away from my apartment, which is kind of sandwiched right between the two bridges. The Zakim Bridge is a modern cable-stay bridge, meaning it has this beautiful spiderweb of white steel cables that run directly from the deck to the two central towers. It carries 10 lanes of highway traffic, which makes it one of the widest cable-stay bridges in the world. And it rises at this really steep angle to connect Boston's Central Artery Tunnel with the double-decker I-93 highway that runs north to New Hampshire. The towers were built to resemble the Bunker Hill Monument nearby. And at night, floodlights make the cables in the towers glow in a variety of beautiful colors. In just the short time since the Zakim Bridge opened in 2003, it's become a global icon for the city of Boston. And the price tag for the project was just $112 million, which means building this amazing new bridge from scratch cost about one-third as much as just fixing the old Longfellow Bridge. When you live so close to these two bridges, and you're a big infrastructure geek like me, you can't help thinking about the contrast between the two projects and what they say about our real priorities. Sarah and Mark are right that Bostonians love their history. But when you've got so much history, sometimes it feels like it's hard to make room for the future. And in fact, when the Zakim Bridge was first proposed, people here were so startled by the unfamiliar cable-stay design that it almost never got built. So, should we build with the future in mind? Or should we focus on preserving the past? Or maybe the real question is, how can we do both at once? Today on Soonish, I want to tell you more about the Longfellow Bridge and the Zakim Bridge, and how they got here. I'm also going to take you to San Francisco, where there's a proposal for a huge outdoor art project that's forcing people to think about how to modernize their own infrastructure. And I'm going to ask what it all means for the future of today's big cities. Projects large enough to change the character of a city are literally once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. So they're probably worth putting some thought into.
I want to know not just how do we get in and out of the city, but how do people move around within the city?
It's a beautiful bridge.
Where do they go? Where do they need to be?
But maybe in this case, you just build a different, bigger bridge.
And what does it mean in their daily lives?
We should not be spending $400 million.
How much time does it take them to get to their job?
We should easily be spending $1 billion on our most important street.
Those are all the questions that I think we need to ask when we look at these beautiful, big, iconic spaces.
Part of the reason the Longfellow Bridge means so much to Bostonians is that it's identified with Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who was probably America's most popular poet in the 19th century. In the 1840s, Longfellow fell in love with a young woman who lived on Boston's Beacon Hill, named Fanny Appleton. Fanny didn't want to marry Henry, but he kept up his courtship, and every week for 7 long years, he'd walk across the old wooden West Boston Bridge between Cambridge and Boston to see her. Longfellow wrote a poem about those agonizing years, and many decades later, the poem became a popular song.
On the bridge at midnight, while the clocks were striking the hour.
The new steel and granite bridge opened in 1907, and in the 1920s, it was renamed in honor of the poet and the poem. And one thing you need to understand about the Longfellow Bridge is that when it was built, it represented something completely new in America. It was designed in the grand European style with fancy flourishes like the Salt and Pepper Towers, which sit on bases sculpted to look like the prows of Viking ships.
It's the most important historic bridge in the state, in my opinion.
This is Miguel Rosales. He was the original architect for the Longfellow Bridge restoration project.
The Salt and Pepper Towers, which again make the bridge memorable and give it a symbolic appearance, they took inspiration from European bridges. like in Prague and in Paris, you know, but they had beautiful arches. And that was also an innovation at that time. That had not been done before.
But it didn't take long for this architectural gem to lose its shine. After a few decades, the steel spandrel columns that hold up the road deck started to rust. And unlike the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, which is basically getting repainted from one end to the other continuously, the Longfellow Bridge got exactly one thorough paint job back in 1959. And by the time the bridge was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976, it was already falling apart.
I came here to go to graduate school at Harvard in city planning in 1965. And the bridge, you know, was always in the background as something that was clearly deteriorating badly. It has never looked good in all my time in Boston.
This is Charlie Sullivan. He's been the director of the Cambridge Historical Commission since 1974.
The state was not maintaining its infrastructure. I hadn't done so since shortly after World War II. And the Longfellow Bridge, because Storrow Drive goes right under it, you could always look up and see the rusting girders and see that things were falling off it. It was obvious to any observer, but until the bridge had to be closed on an emergency basis in, I think, 2007, when they limited the speed of the Red Line trains to 10 miles an hour and closed off the bridge during the 4th of July celebrations because they thought it was unsafe. So that kind of focused people's attention.
In 2008, Massachusetts set up a $3 billion fund for emergency bridge repairs. And the Longfellow Bridge was at the top of the list. The State Department of Transportation brought in engineers who determined that almost all of the bridge's steel parts above the arches were rusted through and needed to be replaced. And it brought in architects like Miguel Rosales and historical preservation experts like Charlie Sullivan to decide how to do that. Now remember, the bridge was on the National Register of Historic Places. That meant there were strict federal guidelines saying that whatever new parts were added to the bridge, they'd have to look just like the old parts.
Why is that? Well, the bridge is a representation of its time, of the aesthetic approach of the turn of the century, but also it represents the highest level of bridge technology and craftsmanship that was available at the turn of the century. And that's something to preserve where it's possible.
One aspect of bridge craftsmanship that Sullivan and his colleagues thought should be preserved was rivets. And in that single word, rivets. There's a world of pain and a world of glory.
She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter.
Rivets are what my WBUR story was all about. To make a long story short, the bridge's original steel parts were held together by tens of thousands of these thick steel pins. During construction, the rivets had to be heated in a furnace until they were red hot, so that they'd be malleable enough to hammer into place. But hot riveting is a skill that died out in the construction industry more than 60 years ago, as rivets were replaced by welding and high-strength bolts. To rebuild the Longfellow Bridge in a historically authentic way, contractors had to find metalsmiths who could help them resurrect the dead technology. Then they had to invent ways to speed up the process so that they could build hundreds of new spandrel columns. And at the same time, they had to determine which parts really needed rivets and which ones could be bolted. Even after the contractors found a few shortcuts, the process was slow.
The theory of the restoration was that the rivets were important where they're visible. As is always the case, once you start to actually build something, the contractors and the designers think of different ways to accomplish and hopefully cheaper ways to accomplish the same end. It's taken longer than we expected, but I think the historic preservation agencies have been very constructive and supportive of simplifying the techniques that are used.
When repairs on the Longfellow began in 2013, the state said the work would take 3 years, meaning it should have been completed by 2016. It's now at least 2 years behind schedule. Contractors now say the bridge will reopen in June 2018. After a full 5 years of partial closures and traffic disruptions.
You know, it's been a challenge, that project.
I asked Miguel Rosales whether he ever heard any discussion about the idea of simply tearing down the Longfellow and building a new bridge.
The bridge is a historic landmark, it's protected. It would have been very hard to demolish such a, you know, bridge that is loved by so many people. That would have been a big controversy. And the bridge itself is expensive, but I think at the end it's going to look quite great, and you know, we'll have new lighting. It's like a new, you know, new life, and people will be very happy, and people will forget the cost.
From my window, I can already see some of the bridge's old beauty shining through. But not everyone is happy with the way the project is shaping up. For one thing, the finished Longfellow Bridge is going to have even less capacity than it did before the project. Here's former city councilor Tom Keene again.
Granted, it's a beautiful bridge, right? But it is also a bridge that probably is undersized. It doesn't have enough space for sidewalks and bicyclists, which really we didn't have a lot of bicyclists back in 1907. It carries the train back and forth. It will only have now one lane each way, I think, for automobiles. It probably would be more sensible to have two. It's a beautiful bridge, but in all frankness, I think we really should have decided that maybe in this case you just build a different, bigger bridge. I think you could have replaced it, and maybe what you could have done is even kept some of the external trappings of it and either put those same columns up if you wanted to do it, but actually have a wider bridge. But instead, what we've done is even the guts of this thing has to be historically accurate. And quite frankly, the reason we no longer use riveting is because it's not as good as some of the other techniques that have evolved. So we're going to probably have a situation 50 to 100 years from now where there's going to be people saying, oh my God, it's costing us $20 billion to repair this thing because we have to figure out the riveting techniques they used 200 years ago.
That said, the bridge is part of Boston's historical charm, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and so are a lot of things. And that bridge, by the way, wasn't the first bridge that crossed from Boston to Cambridge either. There was a bridge beforehand. And, you know, that, I suppose, had its own charm in history. And they also figured out that it was okay to tear that down and build the Longfellow Bridge. And I think sometimes we sort of fetishize historical accuracy and kind of let that impede progress.
But Bostonians don't always stand in the way of progress. The Zakim Bridge has a very different story, and I'll tell you more about that right after this break. Soonish is brought to you in part by Kent Rasmussen Winery of California. Rasmussen has been famous since 1986 for their purely poetic Pinot Noir, grown in the cool mists of the Carneros region of Napa Valley. And under the Companion Ramsey label, they offer superior quality North Coast Pinot Noir, Merlot, Petite Syrah, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Chardonnay at a wonderful price. I'm a longtime fan of these finely made wines. In fact, right now they're the only wines you'll find on my wine rack. So, take a bottle of Rasmussen or Ramsey to your next dinner party, and you'll be sure to impress. For more, visit KentRasmussenWinery.com. Soonish is also supported by listeners. And now you can help out by pledging to the show on Patreon. Patreon is sort of like Kickstarter, but it's for ongoing projects like podcasts. If you go to patreon.com/soonish, you can sign up to support Soonish for as little as $1 per episode. And you can check out the awesome rewards available at $3, $5, and above. A huge thank you to everyone who's already become a patron, including Bob Mason, Andy Hersina, Lynn Rosenthal, Kieran Wagle, and Julianne Zimmerman. Right now, I'm just $4 away from my initial goal of $250 per episode. So, to support thoughtful audio journalism about technology and the future, please go to patreon.com/soonish and pledge what you can. Or just click the donate button on our website at soonishpodcast.org. Now you can listen to Soonish with the free Radio Public app. It's a great app for finding and following podcasts, and it also has curated podcast playlists from interesting people. They're like mixtapes, but for podcasts. I've curated one myself, and you can listen to it right now in Radio Public. Just visit radiopublic.com to download the app for iPhone or Android. And to go directly to my playlist, visit soonishpodcast.org/radiopublic. And now, back to the show. Before the break, I was playing some tape for my interview with former Boston City Councilor Tom Keene. He was saying that by spending so much money to restore the Longfellow Bridge, planners in Massachusetts were, in effect, choosing the past over the future.
And that's really what we're doing, is replicating the past.
Yeah, in fact, we kind of just proved that we can build a new iconic bridge in the form of the Zakim Bridge.
Right. And the Zakim Bridge, it is now one of the key symbols of Boston. I mean, I don't know if there's a movie about Boston that comes out anymore that doesn't show the shot of the Zakim Bridge. And usually there's a great car chase going across it at the same time. We could have built a great, cool bridge across the Charles here to replace the Longfellow Bridge, and it would become the symbol of Boston for the future rather than Boston for the past.
So while Boston missed an opportunity to build an iconic new bridge at the Longfellow Crossing, the story of the Zakim Bridge is much more forward-looking. The sleek cable-stay bridge replaced an ugly double-decker steel truss bridge that used to bring traffic onto Boston's central artery. That elevated expressway was built in the 1950s, and it was so ugly and so perpetually gridlocked that locals called it the Distressway. Work began in 1991 to demolish the artery and put the whole thing underground. That 15-year, $22 billion project was called the Big Dig. And at the north end of the Big Dig, engineers needed a new set of bridges and ramps to connect with I-93.
And at that point, there was a bridge proposed over the Charles River, which was not very attractive, and there was a lot of controversy about that crossing. That crossing was called Skin Z. You know, it had a lot of ramps, and then there were three separate bridges, you know, over the Charles River, and one of them was a double deck. So, you know, there were many, many lanes crossing. It was a very complicated interchange.
That's Miguel Rosales again. He's a native of Guatemala who came to MIT to study urban design in 1985. And I told you earlier that he was the architect for the Longfellow Bridge restoration. But he was also the person who came up with the idea for putting a cable stay bridge at the Central Artery Tunnel exit instead of a double deck bridge.
And at that time, Secretary Salbucci, Frederick Salbucci, was the Secretary of Transportation, and he really wanted to try to improve the Charles River crossing. I thought it would be a good idea to do a cable bridge, and I felt like it would be something that it was unique and special to the city.
Salvucci liked the idea, and Rosales and a Swiss architect named Christian Menn were put in charge of the design. At the time, there was only one cable stay bridge in the United States, the Sunshine Skyway in Tampa Bay, Florida.
There never been a cable stay bridge in New England. That was definitely the first one. But I think the authorities thought that if they could find a solution that the people would agree and endorse, they were willing to take a risk, you know, going into a non-traditional structure.
When it comes to non-traditional structures, the people in the neighborhoods near the proposed bridge, namely Charlestown and the North End, aren't quick to endorse anything.
I have to tell you, there was a lot of opposition to the cable bridge. It was not really accepted by some groups. They thought it was too modern and too different.
But in the end, Rosales found a clever way to win their approval.
So, you know, when the administration decided that, okay, let's take something about the history and the context and put it on the bridge, I think that helped to sell the design. So you know, trying to put the obelisk on the top of the tower, I think it really helped marketing-wise, of selling the structure.
The obelisks that Rosales is talking about are the pyramid-shaped peaks of the cable bridge's central towers. He designed them to echo the Egyptian-style Bunker Hill Monument on Breed's Hill, less than a mile away.
So it had a lot of benefits, you know, visually and, you know, contextually, like you see the three towers together from some viewpoint, you can see the two towers of the Zinke Bridge and the tower of the Bunker Hill Bridge together, and you can see a visual relationship there. And that was definitely a conscious decision to do that, you know, to help the community accept it.
Right, right. What would you have said to those critics back then who were afraid that the bridge was too modern? You know, what was your pitch for a very modern or futuristic design?
Well, I felt like Boston needed something new, and especially the entrance to the city needed something like a gateway, like a structure that people remember. And for so long, you had come into Boston under the double deck structure. It was not really a very attractive entrance to the city. So, you know, I thought that that would create, you know, this interest. And that definitely has worked. I mean, I think Zakim Bridge gave Boston like a new image, like a cool city, like a, you know, high-tech city, you know, with other things too. It's not only the bridge, but the bridge definitely helped to change the image of Boston.
Rosales is totally right about that. Today, it's hard to find a t-shirt or a postcard or a company logo from Boston that doesn't have the Zakin Bridge on it. It's been universally adopted by Bostonians as a kind of exuberant crown for the Central Artery Project and as an icon of the city's future. And when you look at the relatively low price tag for the Zakin Bridge, it makes you wonder why Boston and other American cities aren't even bolder and more experimental when it comes to construction projects. Big infrastructure investments always represent an opportunity to decide whether to fix something old, or build something that's functional but flavorless, or build something futuristic and spicy. And also an opportunity to think about whether the larger community around those projects is thriving, and who's really benefiting from all the money we put in. Here's my friend Sarah Barkan again.
When I look at a city, when I see a picture of Boston, I am really proud that we have the Zakin Bridge. We were among the first adopters of this beautiful technology that brought us the Cable Stay Bridge. And the Longfellow Bridge is an incredible example of our rich architectural history. But I want to know not just how do we get in and out of the city, but how do people move around within the city? Where do they go? Where do they need to be? And how can they get there? And how long does it take? And what does it mean in their daily lives? How much time do they get to spend with their children? How much time does it take them to get to their jobs? Where are their jobs? Where are their schools? Those are all the questions that I think we need to ask when we look at these beautiful, big, iconic spaces.
There's another city that has lots of big, beautiful, iconic spaces. And that's San Francisco. Before I wrap up, I want to take you there and talk about a giant art project that's intended precisely to help people think about these big issues, about how people move around the city. So I'm on the second floor of an old pool hall on Market Street in San Francisco. The place used to be called Hollywood Billiards, and for more than a decade, the building sat empty. But now it's a temporary demonstration space for a proposed project called Light Rail. It's the brainchild of this man.
I'm Ben Davis. I'm the founder and CEO of Illuminate. That's the nonprofit arts organization in San Francisco, best known for our flagship project, the Bay Lights on the side of the Bay Bridge. We're looking at taking the energy that really was created by the Bay Lights, having it take a right turn up Market Street and transforming Market Street through art. What I'd love to do, though, is just sit here on this bench.
Yep.
We're facing a huge screen. You're actually surrounded by projection screens. This is the light rail prototype demonstration space. So we have of this 2 mile long artwork that's envisioned for Market Street, which is actually 4 miles. It's 2 miles up Market Street and 2 miles back, that through tubes of LED lights reflect above your head the real-time movements of the transit system beneath your feet, our BART system and our Muni system, by tapping into the existing APIs of those transit agencies. We look to activate Market Street, not just celebrating multimodalism and mass transit, but really using light and energy and movement to permeate the economic and emotional divides that have separated Market Street for far too long.
To back up a second, if you've been in San Francisco at night any time in the last 4 years, you've probably seen the Bay Lights. It's an array of 25,000 computer-controlled LEDs attached to the cables of the western span of the Bay Bridge. Every night, the LEDs light up in these fantastic shifting patterns programmed by the light artist Leo Villarreal. The Bay Lights started out as a 2-year temporary installation, but they were so incredibly popular that the state replaced the temporary LEDs with new permanent ones in 2016. Ben Davis was the mastermind and fundraiser who made the whole Bay Lights project happen. And he ended up reinvigorating everyone's love for the Bay Bridge. Now he hopes the Light Rail project can do something similar for Market Street.
Right now we're actually in the heart of mid-market in San Francisco. In some ways people can think of it as the most troubling part of San Francisco's Market Street. It's an area, once you cross 5th Street in the sort of shopping districts, you move into 6th Street and everything sort of changes. Every one of your senses in some ways sort of gets assaulted. It's an area of sort of the sense of despair around it in many ways. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But this artwork is actually a 2-mile-long contiguous work of art that we're working on that goes all the way from one market near the Ferry Building to Van Ness.
You could say that Market Street is to San Francisco as the Central Artery is to Boston. It's the main avenue, and it cuts the city in half, running in a straight diagonal line all the way from the Embarcadero to the Castro. It's got bike and bus and car traffic on the surface, and it's got 2 layers of tunnels underneath, one for Muni streetcars and another for BART subway trains. And the street-level part of Market Street is one of San Francisco's busiest and most contested spaces, especially in the area called Mid Market. It's adjacent to a low-income neighborhood called the Tenderloin, And in effect, it's the front porch for large numbers of people who are either homeless or live in tiny SRO apartments. Now, there's been a bit of a renaissance in the mid-market area since Twitter located its headquarters there in 2012. And the city government wants to put aside $400 million to rip up the existing streetscape on Market Street and rebuild it in a way that's more inviting for pedestrians, bicyclists, and public transportation. But Ben Davis wants to prod the city to think even more ambitiously about what Market Street could mean for everyone in the city.
We should not be spending $400 million. We should easily be spending $1 billion on our most important street and creating radical transformation of Market Street and what can happen. So I would like to raise the stakes. People often say, well, this is our Champs-Élysées. It's like, yeah, I mean, it should be, right? Energetically, this 120-foot wide street that goes up and down, it should have that power and that majesty. Or you think about these parallels like the Ramblas, that diagonal that cuts across Barcelona. It's so magical. Or then absolutely magical things like the High Line in New York.
The light rail project would try to add a dash of magic to Market Street. It was dreamed up by a pair of local artists named George Zisiatis and Stefano Carrazza. And it involves hanging two thin tubes containing colored LED lights from the same catenary lines that hold up the power cables for the city's electric buses. The LEDs would be tied into the control system for the Muni and BART trains underground. And as the actual trains move, the lights would move above ground to show pedestrians which trains are approaching each station and how much time they have to catch their train. At the same time, Davis wants to replace the ugly orange sodium vapor streetlights on Market Street with more flattering and energy-efficient white LED lights. City leaders say they love the project, and Davis has all the permits he needs to get started. But to get light rail built, he's working to raise $10 million from private donors. And one argument he's using is that the light rail installation will draw more people to Market Street, especially at night. That could help people from different backgrounds mix and learn a little compassion. And it could also spur a deeper discussion about what the city should do to make sure that the coming reconstruction of Market Street benefits everyone.
The beautiful thing about the artwork itself, beyond the larger vision for Market Street, let's just focus on the light rail project. It asks no one to leave. It actually solves the matter of diversity by asking more people to come. You know, light has the ability to attract and enlighten, let you see what's there. And in effect, if you're spending a lot of your time on the street, as many people, disenfranchised populations do here in San Francisco, you know, all the better. You have this piece that's sort of your companion. It shines for you more than anyone else in some ways. But the bigger issue, you know, is really what is the experience that our most important street should hold for people?
It's a beautiful vision, but San Francisco is a place where all the big issues of race and class tend to play out in arguments about real estate and rent and construction. To think that an art project could cut through all that is asking a lot. I put that point to Davis using a science fiction analogy.
I'm not sure if you're a Star Trek fan, but as you know, in the Star Trek universe, San Francisco is sort of the capital of the United Federation of Planets, right? And they spend a lot of time showing San Francisco in the movies. And especially in the most recent movie, San Francisco is this magnificent city of vast, you know, 100, 200-story skyscrapers. And the joke is basically, I guess the progressives lost every election for the next 300 years, right? Because the quote, progressives in San Francisco are the ones who are dead set against vertical expansion. And that's not relevant to Market Street necessarily, but it does speak to a certain sort of conservatism among people who have an idea of what San Francisco should look like. And your vision of kind of taking the High Line and bringing it down to street level and making Market Street look that way sounds great, but it's pretty radical. And I just, you know, I wonder how optimistic you are about being able to convince people to unify around a vision like that that's so radical.
Some people say San Francisco is the most liberal city in the world as long as nothing changes. That's the challenge, right? How do you get everyone to lift their gaze simultaneously towards a shared goal? You know, Baylights gives me hope. I know it's just a piece of art, right? But it doesn't have a polarizing position. In fact, it does just the opposite. It has this ability to sort of unite people. I just started it because there was this general impulse to try and bring the energy of the Baylights up Market Street and transform Market Street. And the ideas have been sort of unfurling one upon the next. But it's already stimulated an incredibly healthy conversation. So for me, I don't have all the specifics. I get down to the real simple stuff. Market Street, over the past 50 years, has become a place of fear, and it needs to be transformed into a place of love in the spirit of San Francisco. So let the tensions play themselves out. Let everybody have their sort of immediate set of interests and concerns. But I think if we do this right, we all have that moment to lift to the higher point the gaze of something that's sort of motivating us. And I hope that the idea of a Market Street that really is transformed, that really belongs to the city of San Francisco, that actually the rest of the world would scratch their head and say, how the hell did San Francisco do that? Let's follow their lead.
The light rail installation will be temporary, but big infrastructure projects are supposed to last for decades. They last so long that in the course of a human lifetime, a community gets basically one shot at designing or redesigning its most important bridges, buildings, streets, and highways. That's our one chance to preserve the past and shape the future. So why not be bold about it? Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. The show's theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. Additional music this week by Tim Beek. You can find and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio Public, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like Soonish, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really does help other smart listeners like you discover the show. If you've never written a podcast review, that's okay. I've posted step-by-step instructions in the extras section of our website at soonishpodcast.org. At the website, you'll also find more information about all the people and ideas in this episode, as well as the music playlist and a page where you can sign up for our free email newsletter, Signals from Soonish. You can follow and like the show on Facebook, and I tweet about the show at Soonish Podcast. Soonish is a proud member of the PRX Podcast Garage, a community recording studio and workspace in Alston, Massachusetts. For more information, go to podcastgarage.org. Thanks this week to Daniel Sheehan, and special thanks to our sponsor, Kent Rasmussen Winery, and their purely poetic Pinot Noir. And thank you for listening. I'll be back with a new episode soonish.